It's a nice day out. Now, according to our esteemed mentor, Professor Mossy, we're supposed to take an excursus today. And in my discussions with various intellectuals around campus, we have yet to find out what an excursus is. But if I use the word liberally, it seems that Professor Mossy himself is taking something of an excursus out of his class. And the class itself seems to be taking a quick excursus. But those of you who are remain here, valiantly warming chairs, let's take our own excursus, to use the overused word on it. What we're going to deal with today, what I'd like to talk about today, is the Paris Jewish community in the 1930s. And I think this has relevance, aside from the fact that I'm working on it for a doctorate, and I have to admit that, otherwise you might be amazed by my growth. But it has relevance, of course, I think, for three major reasons, and this is the way I'd like you to look at it as we go along. One, because it's a study of Jewish community in the 20th century, or in the late 19th and 20th century. And that includes organizational structure, economic structure, social structure, and so on. Something which, for various reasons, I know I've discussed it in my section, we haven't really been able to get around to. It has to do something, it has much to do with the way that Professor Mossy approaches history, but be that as it may, maybe we'll get into it and it'll give you some idea of what a community might have looked like. Second of all, it's one of the few communities with a sizable proportion of both Western and Eastern European Jews, which is quite interesting because it can give you some idea of where both communities stood in the 1930s. Okay, and particularly this is important for Eastern European Jews because, again, we've been giving rather short shrift to Eastern Europe, and immigrants brought many of their values, many of their attitudes, many of their structures along with them when they came to Paris. This is indeed true of New York and London and so on, Chicago. Third of all, it will give you some idea of the attitudes of both these groups, that is Western and Eastern European Jewry, to Nazism. And Nazism, if we view Nazism as the culmination of some of these folkish, some of these anti-Semitic ideas that we've been discussing in class and that you've been reading about, it will have some relevance, I think. Okay, now I'm dealing with the Paris Jewish community. The Paris Jewish community in the 1930s had about 150,000 Jews, was the third largest Jewish community in the world, behind Warsaw and behind New York. Okay, it had about 100,000 Eastern European immigrants, 50,000 native or French Jews, and a floating population of about 40,000 German refugee immigrants on their way to the United States from Eastern Europe or Central Europe, or on their way back to Central or Eastern Europe. And it's a kind of oddity, it seems to me, that in 1930, here is a profoundly important Western European Jewish community which has a vast majority of Eastern European Jews. But that's what happened. Now, only 50 years before, that is in the 1880s, the Paris Jewish community numbered no more than 40,000. So it goes from 40,000 in 1880 to 150,000, and that's a conservative number. There's a lot of discussion about that. Now, of those 40,000 in 1880, to give you some idea of the development of this community, most of them were Sephardim and Ashkenazim. Now, Sephardim were the first to come. Sephardim are Jews of Spanish or Portuguese origin, many of whom could trace their ancestry to the expulsion of 1492. Now, Sephardim came to Paris in the 19th century, essentially from Bordeaux and from Provence in the south. Many also came from bordering countries, Holland and Belgium, and they found new economic opportunity in Paris. However, in the long run, that is, by the 1880s, Sephardim actually have, their influence is rather small. They represent only about 1,000 out of the 40,000. But there are many notables who are Sephardic Jews in Paris. Far more important are the Ashkenazim. Now, the Ashkenazim, you may be familiar with these words, this is a Jew of essentially Germanic origin. And most of the Ashkenazim who came to Paris in the 19th century were from those wonderful two territories that we talked about, Alsace and Lorraine. I don't think I have to put that on the board. Alsace and Lorraine were, and it was particularly marked in flux in 1871 and afterwards, when Alsace and Lorraine, which had previously been part of France, were now annexed by Germany as a result result of Germany's victory in the Franco-Prussian War. So you get a rather large influx to Paris of these Jews. Okay? Now, it is the descendants of these two groups who conquered in the early and mid-19th century, the Sephardim and Ashkenazim, essentially, who are to be the leaders of the native or French Jewish community in the 1930s. Now, the largest increase, however, is to come after 1880. And how do we explain this increase? We explain it by, obviously, Eastern European immigration. The first immigrant from Eastern Europe to come, there are some examples of Eastern Europeans in Paris beforehand, but very small, maybe hundreds, nothing more. Came in the 1880s and 90s, largely from Russia as a result of pogroms, assassination of the Tsar, and then later on the abortive revolution of 1905. These Russians were soon joined by Poles, Hungarians, Romanians, Bulgarians, who came for many different reasons. Some fleeing their own pogroms, some seeking economic betterment. Many of the reasons, I suppose, why European immigrants came to America in certain ways. And others coming for educational opportunities. Thanks to the static birth rate of the natives, and if we assume natives, meaning, as I said, these very early immigrants, population increase is minuscule. In other words, if they were, let's say, 40 or 35,000 in 1880, they're probably no more than 50,000 in 1930. Thanks to that kind of minuscule birth rate or static birth rate, Eastern Europeans become the dominant element in the community in the 1930s. And what I want to trace is the two different communities. So we have a Western European community, again, these two groups, which are referred to as natives, though I hope we understand now that most of them were really earlier immigrants in a certain way, and this Eastern European immigrant community. They had different social structures, economic structures, political ideas, attitudes towards anti-Semitism. Okay, quickly, when we come to the problem of social structure, I would say that by and large, the earlier a Jew came to Paris, the higher his social standing. This is, I suppose, an axiom of social study, in a way. And that is assuming a certain social mobility, which indeed there was in Paris. If we talk about the native social structure, the economic structure, it's a sort of hierarchical. At the top are the so-called Jewish nobles. We've already had mention of these. These are the heirs of the court Jew. This is what Rothschild fits into. They were often titled barons and so on. Many came in the early 19th century. Rothschild, I believe, came in the teens of the 19th century. That is the Rothschild family. Most of them, of course, were in banking and high finance, and they were very, very active in Jewish community affairs, as we shall see. Other natives were involved in businesses, textiles, fine machinery, precision machinery, and jewelry. Some were also in commerce, and that would include shopkeepers, large store owners of finished products, and also wholesalers, distributors of raw material, cloth, and so on. Also, one finds natives in surprising large numbers in the liberal professions, meaning doctors, dentists, lawyers, professors, and so on. Interestingly enough, only 5%, natives represented only about 5% of the Jewish labor force in Paris in the 1930s. So you see, it's essentially a middle class, upper middle class group. When we move to immigrants, we see the profound difference. Although some older immigrants who came before World War I, these Russian immigrants, for example, that I mentioned, were able to rise in social scale, they eventually set up their own stores and shops in Jewish neighborhoods. They were never really able to get out into the Paris community as a whole. There were few immigrants at all who ventured into the French economy and serviced non-Jews. But they were very wealthy, many were very wealthy within servicing the Jewish community. Those who arrived after World War I were one of two things. Either they were peddlers, and this again, you'll see a lot of parallels here between the American situation that leads to the turn of the century and the Paris situation here. Many were peddlers, secondhand dealers, and so on. By far the majority, however, were in what were known as the Jewish trades. And the Jewish trades were essentially clothing and textiles. Here again, we have a parallel with the Booth of New York is turning. 50,000 Jewish workers or Jewish laborers in the two trades. And here, in the Jewish faith, which is extremely important, one sees the division, a real social division, between natives, older immigrants, and the more recently arrived. The natives, as we expected, were at the top. They were involved in the commercial aspects. Again, distributors of cloth or the sellers of clothing on the big boulevard of Paris. For those of you who have been in Paris, how many have been in Paris? Anybody here? Okay. Well, on the Grand Boulevard, or known as the Grand Boulevard, Galerie Lafayette, these sort of areas, Au Printemps, all these large stores, these were often native owned, and they specialized in clothing. The older immigrants were generally the owners of these small workshops, which were the core, it seems to me, of the Jewish trades. And the newly arrived, as we can suspect, made up the bulk of the labor force. Now, this was not always willingly so. In other words, many newer immigrants, and what I mean by newer immigrants, immigrants who came after World War I, and that is kind of the dividing line between older immigrants and newer immigrants from Eastern Europe, had a rather militant background. We're coming here into the problem of Jewish socialism and Jewish communism, which I'll expand on. But many did have a militant background. Many had come from big cities, having escaped the ghetto or the shtetl, and had joined big industry in Warsaw and in other cities, had worked with the working class. And when they came to France, they were often contracted to come as immigrants, as laborers. They often worked in the north, in mines, or in big industry, to the extent that France had big industry. Not very much. But because of economic crises, which will become increasingly important around the world, and in France indeed in the late 20s and early 30s, they were thrown out of these jobs, and they were forced to become what were known as home laborers, or façonniers. Façonniers, meaning someone who fashioned something with his hands. Now, the façonnier or home laborer are really the central figures in the Jewish trades. And I mention them again because it has a parallel with the Jewish situation in Western Europe and indeed in America. These were not workers in factories. They were artisans. They worked at home. They had their own machinery often. They worked in a room. They worked by piecework. They did not get salaries, so they were paid by piece. They were paid generally very poorly. Often they were illegally working. That is, they could not get a working permit. They worked illegally. Hence, they were exploited. Obviously, if you work illegally, you're going to keep your mouth shut. You're not going to talk up, and you're going to accept any conditions you're given. And so they indeed were exploited by some of these older immigrant owners of businesses. They worked very late into the night because they had to get as much out in the shortest amount of time. There were many accidents, obviously bad lighting, poor conditions, this will lead to hazards of various sorts. They were uncovered by any sort of contracts or social security and so on. And they were also in continual conflict with authentic workers, those who worked in workshops. You see, there was a tension. What the owner would do is, rather than pay these workers in workshops, rather than have workshops at all, that is, that would make, let's say, various articles of clothing, why not give out the raw material to these façonniers, to these home laborers? It was cheaper, you didn't have to worry about social security, you didn't have to worry about wages, and so on. And so workers were in continual conflict with these home laborers. I think in general, one can see here, these are artisans, essentially. And that's what the Jewish economic, at least the immigrant economic structure is about. Artisan trade, not authentic working class. Okay? And there were a few authentic Jewish workers, a few authentic Jewish proletarians. This will be a problem for the left, the Jewish left. Obviously, you have trouble talking about class conflict and about the working masses when you're dealing with home laborers who make up the bulk of the community. And like much of the French economy, I think the Jewish trades were more a relic of the pre-industrial past than a harbinger of modern industrialism. Okay, so much of the social and economic structure. Organizations. Native Jews who identify themselves as Jews, and this is a problem. How do we define what a Jew is? It's a problem which is going on. But let's say native Jews who consciously identify themselves as Jews in one way or another generally join what was known as the Consistoire. And the Consistoire, or Consistory, was the central religious body in Paris at the time. And it was part of a larger Consistoire, which was the Consistoire of France and Algeria. But the one we're concerned with is in Paris. This was the central religious body, and it was rather traditional, and it was recognized by the government as a sort of quasi-official spokesman of the Paris Jewish community. As a central religious organization, as one would expect, it carried on most of the religious affairs of the community. It maintained synagogues, and some of you again who've been in Paris may have seen some of the synagogues, rather ugly names, but rather imposing in a sort of Neo-Babylonian style, I suppose. Engaged in functioning overseer in kashrut, meaning kosher butchers, kosher slaughterhouses. They set up a Jewish law court, officiated religious marriages, burials, and deaths, and so on, ceremonies. Also non-religious functions. And this shows you that this was something more than, let's say, a Jewish synagogue or a Jewish religious organization in the sense in which we understand in America. It was indeed a community body. It had charitable organizations, credit unions, schools, libraries, mutual aid societies. It was a whole communal structure. Frankly, though, however, it only had about 6,000 members. 6,000 members, which I'm kind of extrapolating figures, is about one-third of the natives in Paris. Not very much at all. But of course, it had influence, because it did do all these other things. In other words, those people who were Mary members might have gone to the cultural affairs, they might have sent kids to school, and so on. It was strongly subsidized by the Rothschilds, who made up something like three-quarters of its budget, and indeed Rothschilds were its presidents through most of the period, through all of the period. What it lacked in numbers, it made up in influence. Again, it had largely upper middle-class membership. Its membership fees were very expensive. And as a result, it had a certain sort of influence in government circles, which is going to become very important when we talk about the Jewish response. Now, what about a reform movement? Now, Professor Mossi, I thought, rather hedged around the question of why no reform movement in France. And a number of people asked, at least asked me, and I might have asked Alex about this question. It's a difficult question. Indeed, I met a girl from Brandeis who is in Paris now, as far as I know, is working precisely on this question. And yes, Virginia, there are people working on French Jewish history. And this girl is. And she's working precisely on this question, why no reform movement? There was a reform movement, a very small one, and it still exists today. For those of you who have any interest in it, I can fill you in on it. But it was very small, essentially borrowed from the German movement, what we've been studying, Geiger's movement and so on. And there have been many reasons given for the lack of a reform movement. I'll throw some out, and some of them, I only have three, but a number of them, or one of them might be valuable. I'm not really convinced of all of them. One is obvious, because the Côte d'Histoire, their traditional organization, was very, very willing to reform. This is a difference between the German experience and the French experience. German orthodoxy was generally rather isolated, rather rigid. That's a valid question, at least rather strict orthodoxy. Côte d'Histoire had a tendency to reform, sometimes a little too willingly, so that it instituted, though traditional, instituted an origin, instituted Protestant dress, instituted French language into its services. You see, when you have a movement like that, which though traditional, maintains kashrut, maintains kosher, and so on, it's still, obviously, a reform movement that has very little to fight against. You've been working within the country for a while. Second of all, and just something I throw out, and Marcy seems to throw out, though I didn't quite understand it, and that is that France was a Catholic country, and there might have been a feeling that either you were all or nothing. The notion of Catholic reform is a very nebulous one in France. There were certain Catholic reformers, but not really very successful. Essentially, it seems to me, if you identify with France, you're either all or nothing. And this is true in Europe in many cases. If you go to Europe and people looking for a less strict service and so on, you're going to find difficulty. Most synagogues tend to be traditional, not conservative or reform or reconstructionist or halfway complete. It's generally all or nothing. There are no more. Okay, besides religious organizations, we're still talking about the natives. There were some political groups on the left and the right, and this is going to become increasingly important because France, as much of the rest of Europe, and indeed one could argue about America too in the 1930s, there was increasing polarization between left and right. That's political. You have to make a choice, either left or right. This will hang up Jews who maintain that liberal tradition that Professor Mossi talked about last time. There was a group on the left, very I think Marv's group called the International League Against Anti-Semitism, which still exists today, has expanded its involvement now about against racism and anti-Semitism. Extremely militant group, the most militant group in the Paris community at the time. Boycotts, for example, when German films were shown in the 30s in French movie theaters, they would, a sort of Jewish cleanse, they would go in and disrupt the thing. If anti-Semitic bands would come into Jewish neighborhoods, as indeed happened, they would come armed with sticks and clubs and beat them up and things like that. Obviously here, I mentioned the Jewish defense thing, but I mean that, I don't want to carry that analogy too far. I mean, when we're talking about the 1930s, we're talking about a Nazi movement, and we're talking about anti-Semitism, writ very large. I mean, we're not talking, we can debate here about Jewish defense things, but I'm saying, in the 1930s, it was a do-or-die situation. Most people understood that by the late 30s, at least. Okay? Okay, and there was also a group of patriotic natives, very much this move to the right that Professor Mossack's been talking about, stressing their interest in French patriotism and having nothing but disdain for these immigrants who were left-wing agitators. Okay. Finally, an organization that should be mentioned is the Alliance des Travailleurs Universels. Some of you may have heard of it, the Alliance. It's an organization which maintains a very impressive library in Paris today and was organized about the 1860s. Generally not concerned with French affairs per se, but rather with the plight of Jews in North Africa and in the Middle East. And it sets up schools and so on. And for our interest, I think the tie here is that it was very active in a number of ritual murder accusations in the 19th century. As a matter of fact, the reason for its founding originally was to oppose a ritual murder accusation like the movement. Okay, Eastern European organization. Again, I'm throwing these out because there's not much time, but if you look them over or if you think about this, you'll see fundamental differences. Eastern European organizations, in part, a reflection of the ghetto. So that's the shul, or small synagogue, also known in some circles as the shtiebel, meaning the small synagogue, was a very primary factor in Paris. Eastern European religious Jews who came generally would have nothing to do with the Contestoire, and you can understand why. They didn't know the language, they were strict, traditional, none of this organ playing, none of this French language, none of this Protestant dress, none of this espousal of patriotism, let's just get down to praying. And so they organized their own shuls, their own shtiebla. And there were many of them. There are Hasidic ones, and as Alex has mentioned, and all sorts, and they still exist today. You have to search them out. Another organization that was established was the so-called Landsmannschaft, or Mutual Aid Society. Now, Landsmannschaft, again, have a parallel here in America. There are Landsmannschaft still in America today. Landsmannschaft were essentially mutual aid societies. Its membership based around people coming from the same area, hence Landsmann, the notion of Landsmann, someone from the same land, from the same area, and shop organization. Landsmannschaft were mutual aid societies, primitive credit union, charity, burial, social club, library, and so on. Also, I think most importantly, essentially a place of refuge for immigrants who did not know the language, who was hassled in France in the 1930s. Very important. They eventually joined into a very loose federation, and that was organized in 1926. This federation still exists today. It was, in the 1930s, the largest organization in the Paris Jewish community, having, again, something around 50,000 members in it. And this, in turn, had its own cultural organization, its own library, its own school, its own university, and was indeed, I think, interestingly enough, to be the sort of foundation for the new immigrant community in Paris. And that's very crucial. There was a sense, I think, in which immigrants had come to Paris just as they took a while, but when immigrants came to America, there was a sense that immigrants were going to stay and set up their own community. The Federation was going to be the building block. And we'll see what happens to the Federation. Okay. Now, more recent immigrants. Now, if I mean more recent immigrants, I suppose I mean those who come in the early 30s and maybe the late 20s. And I'm talking essentially about militants, revolutionaries, communists, Bundists, and we'll have reason to talk about Bundists later on in the course. These are people who have nothing but disdain for the shtetl. As I mentioned, many of them had come to big cities and worked in factories. Now, this all sounded, the shul, the linesman shop, all of this was a return to the ghetto. They had just escaped. They didn't want to come back. What they did was to set up their own sort of revolutionary milieu. So they created their own mutual aid organization, their own credit union, a Jewish section of the Parti Communiste Français, the French Communist Party was established, a Jewish section in labor unions was established. This was going to be, in their own sense, another community, but a revolutionary community. In a sense, of course, though, you can see already that despite the rejection of the isolation of ghetto life, they're setting up their own sort of ghetto, and indeed they did for a long while. They were very, very bound together into their own so-called revolutionary mutual aid society, the revolutionary group. And the reason for this is because they were rather taken aback by French left-wing movements and by Western European left-wing movements. There were people who worked in the underground all their lives. I mean, the underground movements, these were illegal movements. They were bitterly oppressed. Most of them had come actually after escaping from prison or escaping from certain punishment. I met a number of them who are no longer communists, interestingly enough. But this was what they presented to me. And they told me that when they came to Paris, many of them were extremely sectarian, you can imagine. If you worked all your life in the revolution, you know, and you're continually oppressed and continually persecuted, you really have to look to the future revolution. That's your only hope. They came to a Paris Communist Party meeting, and there were these people singing the International. They were singing, and they were dancing, and they were serving wine, and all this sort of stuff, and it was in this luxurious hotel, I mean, relatively luxurious hotel, because the French Communist Party, of course, was a rather well-heeled party. They were shot. This was bourgeois. This was not revolutionary. And indeed, many of them refused to join the French Communist Party. Okay. Besides these so-called revolutionaries, there were also a small group of Zionists, very highly fragmented. Zionism has become increasingly important during and after the war, and Zionists have played an important role in the resistance in France, which we won't get into. But before the war, relatively unimportant. And the reason for that, essentially, is that I think immigrants who came to Paris were worried about staying in Paris. That is in the beginning. And by the time they thought about the fact that maybe they wouldn't be able to stay in Paris, it was almost too late. And so what you find, the Zionist movement, which is very highly fragmented, and it runs the gamut, very typically Jewish, between a right-wing movement, revisionism, if you know Jabotinsky's movement, to a left-wing movement, not communist, but revolutionary socialist, and in between all sorts of nuances, and great hostility, fantastic hostility among them, which fragmented them still further, largely immigrant. Okay? All right, Jewish identification, a much more broad concept. And here, we talked about both natives and immigrants, but I think you have some idea of what native Jewish identification is about already, since it's precisely what we've learned about the emancipated Jew. But the rise of Nazism, the reason for its interest here is that the rise of Nazism gives added urgency to the question, it seems to me. You no longer could decide whether you wanted to be a Jew or you didn't want to be a Jew. The racial element forced it upon you. You were a Jew whether you wanted to be or not. And that meant those who already committed to Jewish identification asserted their identification more strongly. Those who weren't committed had to think about it for change. Okay, I think I'm running a little behind, I just wanted, the native Jewish identity is something which you should all know. It's still an attempt at Mendelssohn sort of balance, a disassociation from pre-emancipation ghetto life backward, a rejection of outworn tradition, an acceptance of France as the home of emancipation, and yet the maintenance of religious identity. Notice the Mendelssohnian balance. Gratefulness to France, the notion of Frenchmen of Mosaic persuasion, which we've talked about already. That is, the only Jewish identity there was of any worth was a religious identity. And that was that you were Jew in the home, in your own little ritual, or in the synagogue, but this had very little effect upon when you went out on the street. Jew at home, Frenchman in the street, so to speak. This also meant the disassociation from other Jews. Immigrants were kind of exaggerated stereotypes of pre-emancipation Jewry. They led a too visible existence. This was not only that they were bad-mannered and uncultured, you know, they didn't know the language, but also they seemed to assert their Jewish identity a little bit too strongly. It went beyond the kind of narrow religious identification. Surprisingly enough, some of them did support Zionism, but as one can guess, not Zionism for French Jewry. French Jewry, the emancipated Jewry, had no need for Zionism. The only people who had need for Zionism are the poor co-religionists whom they condescendingly viewed as being unfortunate. They could not partake in the democratic country such as France. They were unfortunately born in one of these reactionary backward countries. So Zionism was a good place to put them. And also, frankly, as you get into the late 1930s, it was a good place to put them because France didn't want them. So let's support Zionism. Let's get the Jews out of France, those immigrants who were causing all the trouble. Let's get them over to Palestine. At least let's get them out of our hair, which is a very real position. And I say it cynically now, but it is a very real position. And it might have been a position in America, too. Eastern European immigrants, three bases of Jewish identity. And this I want to spend a minute more on. One, religion, obviously. They were formed by the assimilation of natives, and they brought over this ghetto life. Now, if you remember Cotton's book, this is what they were hoping for, at least those who religiously identified themselves. Religion subsuming all aspects of life. If you remember, I don't want to go into it, Cotton. If you look at Cotton, you know. They had no concept of the division of a secular and religious realm, such as the Frenchman did, you know, Jew at home, Frenchman in the street. You were a Jew in every aspect. Okay? In actuality, of course, it's hard to maintain a religious identity. One, because you come to Western Europe, and you come to America, you're exposed to new ideas, it's a freer atmosphere, and so on. Second of all, because there's a high price for kosher food, for example, which is a cardinal aspect of it. Third of all, because of the work situation in the Jewish trade, the fact that you had to work on a Saturday, on the Sabbath. And third, fourth of all, I suppose, many came without their family. And it's very hard. And I know that it's very hard to maintain Jewish practice and Jewish ritual when you're alone, when you're isolated. Okay, second of all, another concept which we might talk about, and that is Yiddishkeit. Okay? Now, Yiddishkeit is a very hard thing to translate. You may have heard it many times. I think what I call Yiddishkeit would be the sum total of the Eastern European cultural experience. Okay? That's probably a bad explanation, but it's the only one I can really come up with. You have to feel it. And this is precisely what they said. I mean that cynically, and I don't mean it. There was a sense in which there was a Jewish soul. And the term is used. A soul which everyone partakes of, and which you could never lose. If you came from this area, you could never lose it. That is, came from Eastern Europe. You could never lose it, no matter where you travel in the diaspora. The medium of transmission of this was obviously the Yiddish language. And as long as you maintain the Yiddish language, you maintain that tie with that Eastern European life. Once you broke it, you were destroying a vital link. And obviously, this also meant that anybody who... The Yiddish was part of the popular folklore. Nobody would be interested in Yiddish if they didn't ever have any experience of this Eastern European cultural life. It isn't sort of a language, from their perspective, that you learn in a course. You've got to get it from the guts, essentially. And there's a word for it. One in Yiddish, you call it a mamalush. You call it something which you almost learn on the knee, you know, on your mother's knee. And that's very true of this ideal. Okay, the third idea is Klal Yisrael, Klal Yisrael in Yiddish, which again is a hard concept to define, I would say, essentially meaning that all Jews are tied up with one another in one way or another. This is not a notion of Jewish nationality necessarily, but a notion of participation in an ongoing tradition. By participating, you identify with Jews 1,000 years before, 500 years before. Vertically, in other words, in terms of time, and horizontally, in terms of geographical area, no matter where you are. That is, while you're here in Madison, the person in Detroit is doing the same thing, and in Oshkosh, or whatever. That's not very exciting. That wouldn't carry me on, I think. But anyway, okay. I throw out a kind of question here. I talked about the Jewish soul. I talked almost quasi-mystically about this. And indeed, it's got a kind of wolfish quality to it that I've been thinking about, but I don't want to make any parallels here, because then I'm getting into playing with ideas, which are esteemed mentors. Okay, finally, Jewish identification, left-wingers. And I mention them not because we all love left-wingers, but essentially because they're very important in the 1930s. Now, from the perspective of a good Marxist approach, what's the attitude towards these things? One, religion. Opiate of the people, obviously. Bourgeois exploitation. You use religion, everybody should be familiar with the Marxian argument about religion. Religion is used to obfuscate class consciousness, dulls class consciousness, allows exploitation. Rabbis and parasites. And one of the interesting things I found is that there's an incredible anti-clerical movement among the Jewish left, something which you would not necessarily expect. I don't think many people, at least I was never familiar with a particularly strong anti-clerical movement in Jewish communities in America, certainly not. Not in the sense in which we understand it vis-a-vis Catholicism, but yet there was. Yiddishkeit, remember. Yiddishkeit, a return to the ghetto. Who wants that? It's reactionary. Okay? Mystical nonsense would be the word. Qualities rule, all of these things. Ignores class differentiation. Obviously, the Jewish bourgeois is as bad as the non-Jewish bourgeois. There is no such thing as Jewish unity. There's only class unity. Maybe eventually, after the revolution, there might be something about Jewish nationhood. And for those of you who don't know, the Soviet Union had an experiment to build a Jewish autonomous republic called Bir Bujan, which failed in the 30s, but this was something that some of the left looked to as a possibility of Jewish cultural and national revival after the revolution. But before the revolution, no go. Jewish bourgeoisie is as hated as the non-Jewish bourgeoisie. The only tie you can have is with the masses. So the only hope is to band together with the non-Jewish working class, the French working class, yet this was not assimilation. And the interesting thing is, despite all of this, they were violently against assimilation. And they couldn't avoid the pull of tradition. They maintained Yiddish. And when you maintain Yiddish, you're in trouble. Because it means that you maintain all sorts of religious-oriented expressions, concepts, words, ideas. You maintain the ancient classics, which they did. Peretz, Shoalei, for those of you who know. Of course, they reinterpreted it to become something rather strange. So that Shoalei, for example, who was a nice, pleasant fellow, ends up as a flaming revolutionary. But this is necessary because you can't, there is a, see? There is a Jewish soul, so they would say. You can't get away from it. And that's what they would do. And this is a continuing dilemma on the left, it seems to me. You know, we continue with the dilemma for any Eastern European Jewish leftist, whether communist or Bundist. How much are you a separate Jewish entity? What is the notion of a Jewish entity? And what does it mean to be part of the working class masses? Where do you stand? Should you be separate? Should you integrate yourself? And where is the dividing line? Okay. Now, in the few minutes we have left, I'd like to talk a little about the actual reaction to Nazism. Because here you see all of these differences that I've talked about. And I know I've gone very fast. And I've spent a lot of time, possibly, on meaningless detail. But I think it's important because we don't have very much time to talk about Eastern Europe, unfortunately. And I'd rather get as much in to give you a general impression in this way. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it goes. Okay, reaction to Nazism. The natives. And here we're talking again about the Sephardim and Ashkenazim, these native Jewish leaders, Rothschild et al. It seems like natives were more profoundly shaken by Nazism than the immigrants. After all, the immigrants were used to anti-Semitism in one form or another. Many of them had physically experienced pogroms. Others certainly had been told of it since they were, you know, little children. Natives, of course, French Jews, seem to forget about Dreyfus Affair. Interestingly enough, it's rarely brought up in the 1930s, for obvious reasons. It's an attempt to suppress the notion that there could ever be anti-Semitism in France on such a wide scale. Anyway, because this Professor Mossi has talked about this, the Jewish reaction to Dreyfus Affair was rather limited, and the tendency was to keep away from it as much as possible. This is the myth that perpetuates itself among natives. There is no, they've never really experienced anti-Semitism. And they were really unprepared for it as a result. How could it occur in a cultured country? And this is the German tragedy of War II. And if it did occur, wasn't it really against the immigrants anyway, who were too visible? It couldn't be against us. After all, we're assimilated, or largely assimilated, we're patriotic and so on. They failed to understand this phenomenon that we've talked about, the racial element that makes no discrimination between assimilant and religious or visible Jew, that in fact tends to direct its anger at the assimilant, because it's the assimilant from a racial perspective who is polluting the racial purity of the nation. He's the one who's integrating into the German nation or the French nation, not the religious guy who lives in his little area in town. It's that assimilant who's polluting the racial purity. Okay, So, it's not surprising, therefore, the natives really showed very little understanding of Nazism. And this is not condemnatory. We're not condemning here, and we're not judging. It's a very difficult problem. Okay. Essentially, they defined, I think, Nazism as irrational, barbaric, irrational. Somehow the feeling that if it were irrational, it could never really be explained. It was an easy way out. When you say something's irrational, you can't argue with it, okay? Or that it was a tool used by the Nazis to maintain themselves in power, and once they achieved a certain degree of power, it would fall away. It wasn't really a cardinal aspect of it, of Nazism. Religious leaders, as a matter of fact, totally confused, and I think in a certain perverse way, though I admit that value judgment, tended to take a kind of prophetic tradition upon themselves and argued that this was divine punishment. That Jews were being killed or persecuted or what have you because God is punishing Jews. This is a prophetic argument, which you may remember from the biblical prophet, was taken up by many rabbis in France. It did not lead to a very active response, needless to say. Now, there was an ambiguous attitude toward anti-Semitism in France. It could never happen, obviously, in the land of emancipation. Yet it was happening. How to approach it? One, anti-Semitism must be imported from Germany. Couldn't be in France. And indeed, much of this is true. Anti-Semites took a lot of Nazi ideology. But there was an ongoing anti-Semitic movement, which they didn't want to talk about. Second of all, how could it occur? Obviously, it must be immigrants. It's those immigrants who are too visible of an existence, who don't want to integrate themselves, who are political agitators. It had to be that way, because we couldn't be the result. Again, failure to understand the racial argument. How to respond from the native perspective? The liberal answer, and this is what Balsi's been talking about, rational argumentation. If an anti-Semite put out a brochure that there is an international Jewish banking conspiracy, the Consistoire, the Alliance would put out a brochure of some 900 pages giving you a detailed explanation of Jewish banking from 1600 to 1935. Very typical. Okay? Rational argumentation. Downplay public protest. Let's not get into their bag. Let's not be irrational. Let's not be over-visible. Let's not be too public in our protest. Let's be cautious. Let's be fair. Let's be honest. Okay? Also, reliance upon the beneficence of the French government. Obviously, French government is a mediator. It is, believes in the ideals of emancipation. It will never let Jewry down. They oppose Jewish protests. They oppose the boycott of German goods. They oppose the World Jewish Congress. They oppose protests. And they oppose political action, too. Yet there was a polarization of French society between left and right, and that means that there was no middle ground. The liberal is squeezed out in the 1930s. Who wants rational argumentation when the people knocking down your door? And so they eventually do take a stand, and they take a stand on the right, surprisingly enough, and maybe not, in terms of what Mossy's been talking about. And the stand on the right, which really was discredited with the victory of the Popular Front in 1936, that is the victory of the left forces. Okay, quickly again, the German refugee problem, which is something they could not avoid. They were down on Jewish action, as I told you, but they could not avoid German refugee problem. There were thousands of German refugees streaming into France every day. What could they do? Cautious support, very cautious support. Continual contact with government. Notice the liberal thing again here. Very cautious. And as a matter of fact, as the government became more and more against the influx of immigrants because of economic crises, so did the Jews, so did the native Jews. So that by 1935, almost all aid to refugees was completed, finished. And hence the interest in Zionism. Let's move them out. Interest in colonization. Let's move them to Madagascar, to New Caledonia, to the New Hebrides, and so on. Interest in America. Let's get them out of France. Okay. Now, there was a basic reliance upon the government, as I said, and that could only be maintained as long as there was no incompatibility between the interests of the French government and the interests of Jews. Now, the emancipation view, of course, says there is no incompatibility. French government believes in emancipation, believes in the rights of everyone. But 1930 showed that wasn't the case. I don't have to go into that. All of the accessions of the French government, the defeat of the democratic powers in the 1930s, Hitler's territorial agenda, leading to Munich. And Munich is very crucial. To argue for war would be a Jewish interest. I mean, on a very crude level, obviously. You've got to put up a stand. Jews are getting persecuted more and more. To argue for war would be against French interests. French interests were pacifistic at the time. And if you argue for war, you were a traitor. What to do? Problems. It's a problem in the period. Immigrants. let's get to that. Great concern over anti-Semitism. Great discussion of its origins. A lot of talk about scapegoat theory, eternal anti-Semitism, and also an emphasis upon assimilated Jews. We're particularly struck by the tragedy of the German Jews, which shows to me, at least, and I think should show to you, that they had some understanding of this new phenomenon. Why the assimilated Jew? And they thought about it for a while. And they came up with some ideas about the racial component. Okay, it wouldn't happen here, that's what they decided, of course. We're not assimilated, we're going to defend ourselves. But how? Obviously, first, some of them did rely on the government. You have to rely on the government. And they were particularly happy when Blum came into power in 1936, Leon Blum. That's obvious. Blum was a Jew, and there was a lot of talk about Blum's Jewishness. His mother kept approaching home. All these wonderful rumors that came about. Second of all, that the Popular Front was on the left, fighting fascism. We chose the right side, the left and the right side, they're going to help us. But there was always skepticism. Immigrants, obviously, coming from Eastern Europe know that you never trust the government, no matter what they say. You've got to rely on yourself, eventually. So there is a Jewish protest movement, as opposed to the natives. Needed. Boycott of German goods. A world Jewish communist. But it's very weak, because there are many people, many immigrants, but not much money, not much influence. Natives have all the influence, all the money. They're not going to help. Even certain immigrants, welfare immigrants, wouldn't help. They wouldn't cough up any money. The Federation, that I talked about, which was supposed to be the basis of this society, was much too tied to the Consistoire. It had all of these ideas eventually uniting the Paris community with the neighbors. So it generally acceded to what the Consistoire wanted, which was no political action, no Jewish action. Okay. Now, when we come to the left wing, and the left wing comes important now, you know, of course, that in France, there's a Popular Front movement. This is a movement of socialists, radicals, and communists. Essentially a left-wing movement which opposes the right-wing menace of fascism, and eventually achieved victory in June 1946. Now, the brilliance of the left-wing movement in the Jewish community, for a while at least, is that they were able to latch on to this movement. You have to choose, and that's something which we'll get into, I think, further on. You'll have to choose between right and left. They chose left, for obvious reasons. And they were right. I'm saying right in a certain sense. In the sense that at least that came to power. And at least they were right in terms of Jewish interests, in the sense that at least the Popular Front said it was going to help Jews. So I'm saying on that perspective. And for a while, they were doing very well. And as a matter of fact, they created what was known as the Jewish Popular Front in the Jewish community, which surpassed the Federation, this large immigrant group, by sheer activity, almost by sheer numbers. And many immigrants joined it, non-political immigrants, not communists, not socialists, not radicals, but joined it because they wanted some action, they wanted something to be done. But this also involved a change, obviously, from that dogmatic position on Jewish identity that I talked about that the left had. If you're going to appeal to the broad masses, you've got to talk to them. You can't say, well, you're really exploiters. So they started talking about Clausewitz rule. This is one of the reasons, if you know anything about communist ideology in the 1930s, the flip-flop, the communist flip-flop, the opportunism of the Communist Party, it's reflected here. Clausewitz rule, all the progressive masses, no longer working classes, but the progressive masses, who is anybody who wants to fight against fascism. Bourgeois, religion, everything. Religion, I don't have that. Religion, the other thing they attack. Religion is fine. Look at the Maccabees. Look at Bar Kokhba. Look at all these wonderful Jewish heroes that we can identify with. Look at Passover as a holiday of freedom and liberation. You see the difference here. It's an attempt to reinterpret all of these traditions in some sort of progressive way. Yiddishkeit too, an emphasis upon Jewish classics, I suppose. And indeed, they were attacked by the more sectarian left of this sort of opportunistic position. The Bundists, for example, thought they were just horrible. How could you betray the working class? Talk about all of this mystical nonsense, yet the communists did so. They were very successful too. Yet they could never really resolve the question of whether they, again, this question, whether the Jewish Popular Front was really just an arm of the Popular Front, or whether it was really a separate movement. And they talked a hell of a lot about Jewish issues, and Jewish questions, and the Jewish problem. That sounds like a separate Jewish movement. And in fact, the triumph of the Popular Front, which is in June 36, really spells doom, ironically, for the Jewish Popular Front. Because now, the government that you've been hoping for is in power. Why do we have to act anymore? And the Jewish Popular Front created that myth that when the Popular Front took power, it would be all over. We'd have utopia. So people sat back, downplaying inactivity. Second of all, the Jewish communists were very influential in the Jewish Popular Front. The Communist Party was very influential in the Jewish communists. And what happened, just a second, what happens to the Communist Party is that it becomes very nationalistic. Again, for those of you who know anything about it, it starts talking about national unity. It's a complete flip-flop. Now, if it talks about national unity, what role does the Jewish Popular Front? Who wants separate Jewish organizations? We want French organizations. So the Jewish Popular Front goes down the drain. The Jewish Communist section is actually disbanded. We don't want a separate Jewish section. We don't want separateness. Jewish communists are becoming too separate. They're not thinking about France. Okay, so the Jewish Popular Front dies in 1937, and I'd say from 37 to 39, which is another war, obviously, there's a kind of aimless drifting in the community, and you see why. Reliance upon government, which the natives were so happy about, is not working. France is continuing, the French government is continuing to accede to German wishes. Munich, great despair, what to do? What could the Jewish immigrants do? What could the immigrants do? They couldn't rely on Jewish protest. They didn't have the money, they didn't have the influence. There was nothing to do. Great despair, and ironically, the final thing, is that what you have in 1939, right before the war, is a movement which is incredibly interesting called Return to the Ghetto. And what it means is that immigrants, after all of these hopes, in a sense, come full cycle back to the ghetto. Not to return physically to the ghetto, but at least to return to the ideals of the ghetto, the ideals of unity, solidness of the Jewish community. Emphasis upon unity against the hostile forces outside. No one is going to help us. There's nothing we can do. And so I would say that when 1939 comes, Jews enter the war in Paris, both immigrants and natives, very hesitantly, very uncertain, not knowing what will happen, and none of us could ever envision what would happen. And yet, the tragedy is that this community was very vibrant in 1939. And it was only in the process of becoming in 1939. It had great possibilities, but it was destroyed forever, just as Moscow was destroyed forever. Again. Yes. I hope you've been